Now, here's the Moles, Desiree Hellegers, and Dr. Melanie Platt of the Fossil Fuel Resistance Team at 350 PDX.
So before we get going this morning, I just want to put out a quick call to action and solidarity with our brothers and sisters who are being picked up by ICE. Hector Canedo Sanchez, who teaches at the Bridger K-8 school in Portland's Montevilla neighborhood and is the father of a 7-year-old child, is facing the prospect of deportation, as is Irene, no last name given, who was detained by ICE agents on February 18th. All three of her children are profoundly deaf and communicate with ASL. And so there's a call to ask that people contact Wyden and Merkley, as well as Governor Brown, to demand ICE out of Oregon and ask them to reach out to the mayor, ask our listeners to reach out to Mayor Wheeler and ask him why we are deporting teachers, mothers, and children in a sanctuary city. Ask all of these elected officials to please put pressure on ICE for the immediate release of Hector and Irene. So my guest this morning is Dr. Melanie Plout. She's the co-lead for the Fossil Fuel Resistance Team at 350 PDX. Thank you for joining us this morning, Dr. Plout.
My pleasure.
Okay, can you fill us in a little bit on the latest with respect to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's decision on Thursday, or non-decision on Thursday, kind of a delayed decision, and its significance with respect to the movement to stop Jordan Cove?
Yes, well, this has been really a week of good news for everyone who's been fighting this fossil fuel project for the last decade and a half. There are two huge blows. One was the FERC decision that you mentioned, and the other was the decision by the Department of Land Conservation and Development about the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Plan. So the project isn't dead yet, but this was a very good week for our battle against the Canadian company, which wants to build a 220-mile pipeline through four counties, crossing 400 waterways. That would be the largest greenhouse gas emitter in Oregon. So FERC, which is the federal regulatory agency, had rejected this project back in 2016 because of the harm that it would do to landowners and a failure of need. Of course, it was revived, as you probably know, after the election of Trump. But in the past 3 years, there have been tens of thousands of comments written to state, local, and federal agencies opposing this project. There have been rallies, sit-ins, arrests, creative art, testimony, multiple phone calls. And in the past year, we've seen some success. The state agencies have developed a backbone. And in May of 2019, they declined to give Pembina a clean water permit. And interestingly enough, Pembina never reapplied for this permit. Then, last month, the Department of State Lands refused to issue an extension for what's called the fill removal permit, which is anytime you dig in a river or an estuary, you have to get this permit. They declined to give an extension, and Pembina withdrew their application. So prior to this past week, the Pembina had lost two battles with the state agencies, and then last Wednesday, they lost a third critical state permit, which is the DLCD, said that what Pembina wanted to do was not consistent with the Oregon Coastal Management Plan. Probably partly as a result of this decision, we had the rather surprising outcome at FERC the following day. FERC is usually a rubber stamp for gas pipelines. And as we started to listen to the hearing, we thought it was going to be, as it had been in the past, another rubber stamp. The first person who spoke was Chatterjee. He's the chair of the committee, and he, as expected, said, oh yes, Pembina is great. And then the second person, the one Democrat, said, no, this is a bad project. And then, surprisingly enough, Bernard McNamee, who is the third member of the committee, said, I haven't had enough time to digest what the state of Oregon is telling us, so my vote is a nay for now. Clearly, this is not a denial, but it's a very good step in the right direction that somebody actually cares to hear what the state of Oregon has to say.
Okay, and I think Bernard McNamee is probably going to release his position this week?
We expect that he will, although there's no absolute guarantee of that. Now, even if, as expected, he does say that the project should go ahead, this does not mean that it can go ahead. Any approval by FERC would be a conditional approval, and it would be conditioned on the state permits. Now, there could be efforts by the company and the federal government to try to overrule what the state has said, but they cannot do that. And any attempts that they made to do that would end up probably with years in court. So we are moderately optimistic that Pembina may see the handwriting on the wall and withdraw their application. In fact, something akin to that just happened back east. There's a Constitution pipeline that a company called Williams wanted to build, another gas pipeline, and they had been pressing for this not quite as long as we've been fighting Jordan Cove, but it's been 8 years that they wanted to build it, and it was the same thing. FERC had approved it, but the state regulators had said, no, your plan to cross our waterways does not protect our state, and so just a couple days ago, that plan was withdrawn. So we would be delighted, of course, if FERC disapproved or denied the permit for Jordan Cove. But even if they go ahead with it, there's still really, Pembina has very much an uphill battle to get this approved. I think we should be optimistic and we should be very pleased with our state agencies.
Okay. And I mean, recently, just this past week on February 12th, The Intercept did a really illuminating article about Pembina's involvement with the North Bend, Oregon Sheriff's Department and law enforcement there. It was harkening back to a November 2018 event that was organized by the National Sheriff's Association and that focused on training dozens of law enforcement officers and corporate security personnel on how to wage propaganda battles against protesters. And we're also hearing about, you know, certainly involvement in kind of comprehensive surveillance of activists. So, you know, plenty of evidence to suggest both that Pembina is an incredibly bad corporate actor and also that they are basically buying off local law enforcement or attempting to do so.
Yes, absolutely. They had funded 5 positions in the local Coos Sheriff's Department, although recently, as they pulled back some of their monies that they were using to try to bribe the local officials to support them, they pulled the funding for those 5 positions. So again, that was a good sign. But yes, we're seeing this all over the country, attempts to make it illegal to protest against fossil fuel. In a way, I see it as a sign of our strength because we have been so successful in stopping projects that they are trying to up their game. But we're going to win this one.
Okay, well, maybe it's a good thing for us to kind of turn our attention to the trial that's beginning this morning of the protesters against the Zenith Pembina liquid natural gas export terminal in Portland.
Yeah, Zenith is an interesting case where they have found a hole in what we call the thin green line, where we are able to prevent the export of the fossil fuels, which mostly come from the inland west, over to the big markets in Asia. Zenith was able to burrow through the line by taking over an old asphalt terminal. And so they didn't need new permits. It's kind of a glitch in how our permitting system works that even though this was a completely different use from the asphalt terminal, they were able to operate and even to expand under some old building permits. So we've been trying every trick in the book to stop Zenith. We have had multiple testimonies at City Hall. We've had rallies. And last spring, a group of protesters twice put a little house and built a lovely garden on the tracks at Zenith. And some of those who were arrested are probably, as we speak right now, in the courtroom at the Multnomah County Courthouse. I believe it's room 526. There's going to be jury selection today, but the really interesting stuff will probably happen tomorrow and Wednesday if anybody wants to come. This is a really landmark trial because it's the first time that's what's called the necessity defense has been allowed in Oregon. And the necessity defense says that we did something wrong, but it was the lesser of two evils. It's like breaking somebody's door because their house was on fire. We had to do this because we had no other option to try to save the planet.
Okay, yeah, and I just want to refer our listeners also to the documentary film made by Old Moles, Jan Hocken. Her film is called Necessity, and it's really following the attempts to use the necessity defense in fossil fuel organizing and resistance.
Yes, yes. And there's going to be another trial beginning of May for the valve turner, Ken Ward, up near Bellingham, for those who are particularly interested in this issue. If you are interested in taking action on Zenith, there is a way we are trying to intervene right now at a regulatory level, which is Zenith will come up for its clean air permit in a few months. And part of that is the city has to say that it is compatible with how we want the city to be using our land. It's called the Land Use Compatibility Statement. And we are asking the city to stand up firmly and say, no, Zenith is not compatible. So if you are interested in taking an action on Zenith, you could call Mayor Wheeler or Commissioner Udaly Fritz or Hardesty and let them know that please tell Zenith that their action is not compatible with how we want the land in our city used.
Okay, and are there any is there any sense of the likelihood of the necessity defense flying in an Oregon courtroom at this point?
People think that, you know, and I'm not an expert in this, but people do think that there is some possibility that juries in Multnomah County, which is a relatively progressive place, may be sympathetic to this argument because we have more probably knowledge about the state of the climate here in the city of Portland or in the county of Multnomah than we do in other places. So there are some other fossil fuel fights that I just want to be sure people have on their radar. Some things never seem to die. One of them is there is a methanol plant that a company wants to build up in Kalama. And Kalama, as you know, is just only less than an hour from here. It's right on our Columbia River. And this methanol plant would be taking fracked gas and turning it into a liquid called methanol, which could be shipped to China. Now, the company has claimed that this fuel would replace coal in the manufacture of plastics in China. But we know a couple of things. Number one, there's no way that we can be guaranteed that it would displace coal. And number two, the company told its investors that it was going to use this substance, methanol, as a fuel, which means that the greenhouse gas footprint of this plant is even worse than what the company has been trying to say to the regulators. In fact, I believe Columbia River Keepers has sued the company for fraud in respect to its investors. So some very interesting happenings up with the fight against the methanol plant in Kalama. Right now, from the regulatory point of view, it's in the hands of Ecology, which is kind of like DEQ here in Oregon. So if anyone wants to call Ecology and say, please, no fracked gas to methanol, to plastics, or fuel in our Columbia River watershed, that would be great. And then one other thing for people to keep on their radar is Global Partners. So this is a little bit like Zenith because it's the use of an existing facility that has permits to try to, again, take oil trains, just like in Zenith, the tar sands from Alberta, and send it overseas. In this case, they're using a terminal which has been approved for ethanol, which is much cleaner than, you know, the tar sands are the most carbon-intensive form of energy in the world, and they are the worst for the global environment, and they are also terrible for the place where the boreal forest has to be destroyed in order to scrape the tar sands out of the earth. So Global Partners, if it were to be turned into an oil terminal, would be an even larger export terminal than Zenith. And it's only a little bit further away from us. Sadly, there just isn't the publicity about it up in Columbia County, and I think we have a responsibility as activists in Portland to pay attention to Global Partners, which in many ways is even more evil than Zenith.
And this maybe also kind of highlights some of the intersections between kind of the fights to preserve some kind of social safety net and the fossil fuel struggle, because communities that have, you know, are stripped of unemployment, healthcare, livable or strong schools, all of those kinds of important pieces of the social fabric are far more likely to be vulnerable to arguments for bringing in fossil fuel infrastructure. And it's certainly clear that the amount of energy that that fighting these fossil fuel terminals is consuming is taking away from the capacity of communities to begin to address and bring in more sustainable forms of energy.
Yes, absolutely. We know that the fossil fuel companies target what they consider economically depressed regions because those people don't have other options and because there isn't the population base there to fight it as effectively. So once again, I would just say that we in Portland have a responsibility, as I think we have done with Jordan Cove. We've really mobilized very heavily to try to protect the people in Coos County. We have a responsibility to do the same up in Kalama and in Columbia County, where they want to build the Global Partners plant.
And just a heads up also that Barbara Bernstein on Locus Focus at 10 is really going to be honing in on the most recent developments in the Jordan Cove struggle. So my guest today has been Dr. Melanie Plout, co-lead of the Fossil Fuel Resistance Team at 350 PDX. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.